Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your source of reliably libertarian news and analysis commentary, brought to you by the Magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I'm Matt Welch, joined as per the ancient ritual by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy Veterans Day, everyone, and thank you for all for serving.
Did you just call her Catherine Mangu Ward?
Yeah.
Because it's Veterans Day?
I think that is what happened. Yeah.
The D was just a little silent. It wasn't that. I was just kind of going Cuban with it all.
Howdy, Matt.
Hi.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Veterans Day.
So we're going to get to last week's earthquake of a presidential election here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors over at St. John's College. Friends, do you know who is welcome at St. John's College? All are welcome at St. John's College. That's who. From America's founding fathers to the Greek philosophers who inspired them to contemporary critics who are not quite sure that the aforementioned are as awesome as all that. At St. John's College, students encounter Adam Smith and Karl Marx, James Baldwin and Virginia Woolf, St. Augustine and Nietzsche. Here, there are no secondary sources, no experts, and no one telling you what to believe. Instead, it's original sources, researched in a community devoted to collaborative inquiry, intellectual humility, and the open discomfort that comes from encountering diverse opinions. Explore 3,000 years of human thought on campuses in beautiful Santa Fe and historic Annapolis. For master's degree, candidate St. John's also offers studies in the great texts of the East, in person or online. You can learn more at sjc.edu/reason. That's sjc.edu/reason. Go there today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, look, here's the deal. On last week's live Reason Roundtable podcast, we all expressed our strong desire that Tuesday's presidential election not be another nail biter, unlike 2016 and 2020 and 2000 and a bunch of other ones. In that sense, Tuesday was very much we got what we wanted. Former and future President Donald J. Trump, beat Vice President Kamala Harris 312-226 in the Electoral College vote, sweeping all seven main swing states that everyone was focusing on. And as of Monday morning, when we're taping this, with 95% of the ballots counted, because California literally can't do anything, he's up with the majority of the popular vote, 50.4% to 48.0%. Expect those numbers to tighten. Senate, meanwhile, has sorted into a 53-47 GOP majority, with jockeying for a new Senate majority leader ongoing and pretty intense. The House is still being counted up, but it looks like Republicans will have around a 10-seat majority there, give or take. Kamala Harris, best as we can currently figure, did not improve on Joe Biden's showing in a single county in the United States. Trump, meanwhile, made gains in all sorts of previously Democratic strongholds, including big cities and within various minority and immigrant groups. Catherine, with the usual caveats that we should beware of extrapolating too much from a single presidential election that you didn't vote in, it feels like that the vibe shift is real, although I'm not sure what the shift or what the vibe is. Precisely, what is your big picture take from what took place on Tuesday?
I have just become obsessed with what Elon Musk is going to do, per usual, to be quite honest, because that's the scale that I can process right now. So we've got all this chitter chatter about who's going to be on Trump's cabinet. And, you know, one thing that we know from his last term as president is he doesn't listen to the cabinet a lot. He listens to like a couple of people who are his inner circle. And at least for 5 minutes, that's going to be Elon Musk. Now, I think it will only be 5 minutes. That is my prediction. Because it's two big personalities and Trump doesn't really love to share the spotlight. He has done it so far with Musk, so I guess there is that. But as long as Musk is just kind of like bouncing around behind him in a t-shirt, like trying to cut $2 trillion, that's the ray of light for me. It's not a very bright ray of light. And I do, you know, worry that while Musk is doing his trampoline impression, that, you know, Stephen Miller and others will be influencing Trump to do some really horrific immigration policy, among other things. So my big picture is I don't know what's going to happen because no one knows what's going to happen because the vibe shift is entirely specific to Trump's personality and a bunch of things that we don't understand. And we don't know what he's going to do other than a couple of things that he really, really wants to do that maybe legally he can't do that we also don't want him to do. How's that? Is that great?
Analysis?
Good. Yeah.
I would also refer people back to the aforementioned Roundtable Live where we tried to war game what either a presidential candidate might do. For good and for ill. Nick, what's a big picture take from you besides that Patrick Ruffini seems to be totally vindicated, who you've interviewed a couple of times, I believe.
Yeah, and Rui Teixeira as well, who wrote a book with John Judas about called Where Have All the Democrats Gone? my big takeaway, and this is what I'm most optimistic about, is that I think this shows the end of an era of a particular sort of Democratic Party politics that, you know, arguably started with Obama, but then was personified by Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and it attempted to be continued by Kamala Harris. And this is one where identity politics gets a big play, top-down control, what I call like finger-pointing policymaking, where it's like, you know, you're constantly telling people why they are wrong to feel the way they feel, and you don't really care. And when, you know, as Catherine was talking about, virtually everywhere, across almost every possible demographic, every geographic, every psychographic, the Democrats, the top of the ticket, lost votes. And so that means it is a real repudiation of where the Democratic Party was headed. And that's also true in Senate races and congressional races. And I think that's good. I think that should be celebrated. It does not mean, you know, that era of politics is over, but it does mean that Democratic voters have really repudiated it. You know, so I'm optimistic that the worst kind of emanations and excrescences of wokeness and the kind of economic policies that follow from that are kind of put in their place, or they're buried in at least 3 feet of dirt, maybe not a full 6 feet, and we need to put more garlic cloves on them to keep them from coming back. But I think that's good. And then the other thing is, you know, I share Catherine's absolute fear and anxiety about mass deportations and tariffs that are going to cost a lot of money and cause a huge amount of tumult. And, you know, the scale of deportations that Trump is trying to talking about, where he wants to kick out 3 million people a year and things like that, this would be ruinous to the economy. It would be morally disgusting. But it also is going to extend, it would disrupt virtually every aspect of our lives. Obama and W. Bush, did workplace raids in chicken factories and agricultural centers and things like that. If you really want to scale up and if you want to send the message that Trump and his advisors say, people are going to be showing up at restaurants in big cities and going into the kitchen and taking down people's numbers and locking them away and things like that. And the early indication that Tom Homan, who was Trump's border czar in the first place, is coming back, he is, you know, not shy about talking about what it will take and what he is looking forward to doing. So I worry about that. But the optimistic side on the Republican, and Virginia Postrel, former Reason editor, has a very good piece up at Substack about how Trump is a zero-sum guy, but most of his followers, or many of his bigger followers, such as Elon Musk, are abundance agenda people, are progress agenda people, and it is about kind of making more stuff happen. And that's some cause for optimism, as is his embrace of cryptocurrency and his promise to, you know, free Ross Ulbricht and to shake things up. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
Quick follow-up, Nick. You talked about the finger-pointy Democrats. There is a rejoinder that one hears on that, which is that Kamala Harris didn't really run that way. Can you point to something in her campaign that was like that, or is it more that there's an overall vibe of finger-pointiness?
Yeah, I think that it was. She definitely did not run that way, and the Democratic National Convention was a clearly concerted, and I think in many ways, a well-done spectacle to move away from that. It was not about identity politics. She did not really invoke herself either as African-American or Indian or female in her race, but the accumulated weight of what people were expecting from the Democrats. Like, you can't just wave that away. If she had actually articulated some kind of, you know, more detailed policy agenda, that might have helped, but it wasn't. I mean, all she talked about was, hey, we're going to build a bunch of houses and things like that. But I mean, there was nothing to get past the idea, you know, the fact that she was picked as vice president because Biden had said that he was going to pick a woman of color. And then she was given the nomination without any kind of competition. All of that, I just think, you know, kind of locked down the idea that the Democratic Party is not, you know, is not individualistic. It's not merit-based. It's not anything. It was still huffing those fumes.
Now, I'm just going to say on the identity politics thing, I think it's equally true on the other side as well. We had a couple of pieces on the site that said some version of she didn't lose because she's a woman. She lost because she sucks / she lost because she is Joe Biden. And I think, you know, that's the flip side of this. Like she didn't run an identity politics driven campaign as much as she could have, although the party is structured around many of those issues. But likewise, I don't think Republicans or, you know, the people who flipped from Biden voted against her for identity politics reasons. So in that sense, it's good. I can't join you in your cautious optimism. I am for sure pessimistic about what's going to happen in the next 4 years. But that I do think is a good thing.
Peter, is there a big policy? Nick just referenced policy towards the end of there. Besides or in addition to immigration, which is a pretty clear difference, is there a big policy takeaway about the size of the rebuke of Democrats?
Yes, I think it's pretty clear that this election was about a lot of things. And the like my quick take on why Trump won and why Harris lost is just that the libs blew it. And I mean, I'd say the libs like in a kind of derogatory way on purpose, because it's not just the Democratic Party in Washington. It's not just the operatives. It's not just the elected officials. It's the entire sort of left-ish cultural, political, institutional apparatus. They blew it in every possible way. And the reason you know that they blew it in all the ways is that Kamala Harris didn't improve on Joe Biden's performance in a single county. Is that Kamala Harris, by the exit polls, which, yes, are not perfectly reliable, but they're what we have right now, seems to have, also by looking at some of the county data, Kamala Harris seems to have lost ground in nearly every single demographic group, if you slice and dice the electorate. Just losses all around with young women, but in particular with young men. Gen X, you know, really put Trump over the line here. The libs just blew it, but they blew it in a particular way that I want to focus on, which is the economy and inflation. If you look at the polls going into the election and then coming out of it, the economy generally and inflation specifically was the biggest single issue that people focused on, and The inflation, you know, the liberal defense here is that inflation happened all around the world and that, in fact, the United States economy is better in some ways, is maybe the envy of even of a bunch of the other Western democracies. And in fact, this was just a post-pandemic reaction to inflation all over. Basically, every single Western democratic country has voted out the incumbents. And so, you know, it's maybe Kamala Harris did a good job and she was just facing a really tough map and a really tough race. A tough environment. Okay, to some extent, that is true. Like, I think there is something to that argument. At the same time, look at what Joe Biden and the Democratic Party did as soon as they took office in 2020. They passed a $2 trillion unpaid-for stimulus bill that was supposedly the COVID recovery plan, the American Rescue Plan, right? It was about, we're going to get out of COVID. But mostly, it was just a series of handouts to voters, to Democratic interest groups. It was way too big. They were warned it was way too big, not just by conservative economists, but by people inside the Democratic Party saying, this will cause out-of-control inflation. You go back and you look at some of the calculations. And yes, inflation was going to rise no matter what because of pandemic supply chains. But if we had not had the ARP, if we had not had a gigantic, way too big, obviously too big stimulus to start Joe Biden's presidency, instead of peaking at 9% in 2022, it might have peaked at 6%, a much lower rate, probably a much lower anger level as a result. And so I think the biggest thing that Democrats did wasn't something that happened in the past couple of weeks. It wasn't not going on Rogan. It wasn't, you know, some of this, the ads and the messaging that came out. Yes, they screwed the pooch in a bunch of ways here recently. But what they really did was they started out Joe Biden's presidency by saying, let's go as big as we can on inflation. In fact, the argument at the time, if you recall, was we can't, like, it would be a mistake to go too small. We're going to go too big on purpose because we'd rather err in the direction of too big. They did. And now they are paying the price.
Catherine, you sound a little bit sad. There are definitely some people in our universe, perhaps on staff, don't know, not there, and certainly among Democratic voters who are having are pretty big in their feels right now, and not just in their feels, but like genuinely worried about the direction of policy in this country and the things that might happen, and also the chaos that usually associates with Donald Trump. What can you say to our friends out there who are anguished right now? And maybe even what can you say to those people who are overly triumphalist on the other side?
Yeah, this is something that I find a very hard question, because my natural answer here is to go to like back up an order of magnitude and to say, like, this was a bad election outcome for freedom in many ways. Maybe both of them would have been bad, but this one is definitely going to be bad. And, you know, my inclination here is to say, world historically, in a scale of zero freedom to 100 freedoms, we got 98 freedoms right now. And now we have, when Donald Trump comes back, 97.5 freedoms. But not zero, right? It's not the apocalypse. And if Harris had won, also, we probably would not have had plus freedoms. Like, this, I know that that's annoying, because it's the same as when people say, oh, I'm scared to go out in my neighborhood. And you say, actually, crime rates are down. Like, screw you, right? But that is the real answer. The real answer here is I actually do not think that Donald Trump is an existential threat to the United States. I do not think that the world is going to end. I do not think this was the last election. I do think he is going to do horrific policy on trade, horrific policy on immigration, and pretty bad policy on abortion. And those three issues are really important to me. They're really important to a lot of people. And people are right to be worried about those outcomes. I think that the tension between the total Trump loyalists and the kind of hyper-competent Wall Street-y billionaire types who are adjacent to him is going to be determinative. Like, either the loyalists will win, and just if they say yes, sir, whatever you say, sir, they're the ones who stay in his inner circle. That's going to be a much worse outcome for the country, I do think. You know, Jeff Bezos is like, congratulations, sir. I hope things go well for you, sir. And that's at least in part because maybe if he is closer to the Trump administration, that goes better for him, but also probably, in my estimation, better for America. So that's the question. History has shown us that the loyalists win. History has shown us that you can be a evil, incompetent idiot. And if you say, yes, sir, absolutely, sir, in a convincing way, you're going to stick it out. And so I'm worried about that. And
you know,
I share the concerns of people who are worried.
A potentially optimistic take on this, though, is that Trump has bumped Mike Pompeo, who had been his CIA director as well as his Secretary of State, is not going to be in the cabinet or the administration, which I think is good. You know, Pompeo is a torture apologist. He is a regime change dead ender, et cetera. And like, to me, that signals a better foreign policy. Mike Pompeo was still around.
We have a nice, big, juicy Matthew Petty piece up on the site today about, the fact that some of the kind of traditional neocon sides of the Republican Party, by the way, some of whom were embraced by Kamala Harris in end stages of her campaign,
totally.
Do not seem to be ascendant in the Trump administration. I think it's still a question mark, but it's at least not, okay, Mike Pompeo's in charge again, so okay.
Yeah. No, this is one thing that I'm cautiously optimistic on, is that foreign policy is going to be a little bit better because it will be clearer. Trump has signaled, you know, both in Ukraine and Israel and to the Middle East, like, I want deals done, you know, by the time I'm in office, et cetera. That can go disastrously wrong. And, you know, Trump's whole positioning towards Ukraine is complicated because early on in his presidency, in his first term, he actually sent them weapons that Obama had not. He's not a Putin ally. He wants something done, but we don't know what's going to happen. But I think Pompeo being kicked aside is a good sign. The other thing, though, Matt, too, like, for people who are very upset as well as people who are jubilant. It's like, wait 2 years, because this is in many ways a replay of Trump getting in 2016. He's got more of a mandate, but this is the dynamic that we've seen this entire century, which is that it, you know, the existing party gets kicked out. And then the new party comes in with a, you know, a slim or a large majority, you know, of the popular vote for the, you know, for the president and Congress. And then they get everything they want, or enough of that what they want, that they get voted out 2 years later. That happened to Trump. It happened in some ways to Biden. It happened to Obama, certainly. And it took longer with Bush, but it was also that happened to him as well. So wait,
that said, the Senate map looks very bad for Democrats for the next decade or so. And Democrats are going to have a really hard time retaking control of the Senate anytime in the near future. Look, I think if you are a libertarian who is upset about Donald Trump winning with Republicans, also controlling both chambers of Congress, that's going to give him a lot of power. And I think there are many reasons to be upset. One thing you can take some solace in is that some really awful people lost, and they lost in a way where they might actually learn a lesson. Because
I said might, I didn't say they will,
but they might actually learn a lesson here, because I think what we have seen over the last 8 years is that the left establishment, the resistance types, the Democratic, you know, party operatives, the academics, the people in the media who are, they're just reporting the facts, but they're so obviously biased against, you know, Republicans and Donald Trump. They have launched every single possible argument against Donald Trump. The good ones, the bad ones, the completely stupid and inane ones, the ones that are actually correct, because there are many good arguments against Donald Trump. They have launched all of them against him over and over again. They have tried every single thing, and it didn't work. It just didn't work. It didn't work in a spectacular way. Donald Trump gained in nearly every single county versus Kamala Harris performed worse in nearly every single county than Joe Biden did. It just didn't work. They just didn't make the case. People didn't buy it. And so they're going to have to go back to the drawing board. And so in a way, I see this. It's not in the polls in a direct way, but I think you can just see it in the culture, especially if you are following younger, sort of weirder, smarter, contrarian people who are not on the left. This was a revolt against liberal millennial cringe and all of the stuff, all of the stuff that comes with that. The Obamacore, right? Like New York Magazine ran a feature on what defined Obamacore recently, not Obamacare, Obamacore, like the whole vibe of it, right? The cancel culture, wokeness, clapter, John Stewart theory of politics and culture and the universe. This was an election that said to all of those people, nope, your time is over. We're bringing something next. We're bringing the next thing in. And I think that those people will have to go back and try to learn some lessons.
And, you know, to add on to that, the kind of the worst elements or many some of the worst elements of MAGA also lost. So like people like Carrie Lake, you know, in Arizona, which really was ground zero for the I'm trying to come up with a synonym for the R word of ification of the Republican Party in Arizona. You know, like she's got a lot of explaining to do, and she can't explain it away by like, oh yeah, they keep stealing elections from me. It's like, you're an idiot and your political agenda is disgusting even to the people who would seemingly be most amenable to it. So if you know, and that might be the difference between like Arizona Republicanism and, you know, the Paul Gosars of the world, who's an election denier and a conspiracy freak in a particular negative, cramped way, and maybe a Texas or Florida Republicanism, which also suffers from some of that, but is much more open-ended and like, okay, let's just, you know, build a bunch of stuff. You know, that, and I think that version of the GOP is ascendant. You know, where it's not quite sunny, but it's more open-ended.
I saw some suggestion that it would be a good idea for Carrie Lake and Stacey Abrams to go on a nationwide tour together.
No, absolutely.
Why you don't like me or something like that.
They could solve mystery elections all over the country.
That's right.
You know, it's like, oh my God, look, there's voter fraud here. That's why this person didn't get elected.
The Lincoln Douglas of our time, truly.
Them dang kids. It'd be more like the G. Gordon Liddy and Timothy Leary tour of the 80s, which is pretty fantastic for those of us who remember it. I feel senses of optimism and opportunity that I was not planning on feeling, which is nice, and it could be delusion. or justification as well. But the sense in which this was a cultural house cleaning, that vibe shift that Peter was alluding to before, and particularly when you see people who are talking about how now they can, they have the sense that they can speak more freely without fear of being on the butt end of a shaming campaign. That's just finger pointing, yes, but like a group pylon, social media finger pointing that leads to you losing your job. Just talking yesterday to someone who works in the publishing industry at Macmillan, and who all of you know, and she was saying that like one employee at the place just managed to let slip that they were kind of happy about the results. And it's just now a huge scandal within the publishing company with a lot of people who work in publishing and say, yeah, that person really needs to be fired. I mean, that still exists in those institutions. You're going to see, I think, a lot of elected Democrats, and you've already started seeing this with Seth Moulton and some other people, Philip Raines, who's not a elected Democrat, but he's in power, saying, okay, look, we're on the losing end of 85 to 15 issues here. We got to stop it. So you'll see it among electeds first, but the sense of cultural breathing room among people who were legitimately scared of that happening, especially those who don't necessarily, unlike us, live publicly. And so it's unusual to be criticized all at once by people who seem to have power. Well, those people seem to have less power now. And I think there's going to be a freer flow of information. And that's really good. That's healthy for the culture, regardless of whether you think that Donald Trump is a good president or is a good person or anything like that. I think that in itself is healthy. And I want to give a shout out to people who I otherwise spend some time disagreeing with, which are libertarian or libertarian-ish people who jumped aboard the Trump train early and often. They're around. You know, Dave Smith is out there getting retweeted by Don Jr. about not getting Pompeo in the cabinet. I'd rather have that than not have that. I might disagree with how Dave Smith, not even him in particular, got there and the arguments or any kind of compromises that various other people might have made. But we're also looking at maybe Thomas Massey is in the cabinet, although now I'm preempting a future segment on this exact podcast. So I'll stop talking because we're going to get both to personnel and also some of the free speech aspects a little bit later in the podcast. But let's go quickly, Catherine. And we've been talking big picture so far. Let's go to little picture, to ballot initiatives and down ticket races and other kind of things that were out there that might have escaped attention, but that are nonetheless significant. Why don't you lead us off with a suggestion, Catherine?
Yeah, I want to talk about school choice, which did not do well at the ballot box. That is at least in part because school choice doesn't do well at the ballot box. It's actually an interesting thing. Neil Mikulski from Cato has told Reason's own Emma Kemp that school choice has never, at least not that I can think of, been approved in a popular vote. So that is an interesting thing to think about here. People tell pollsters that they like school choice and they want it. But when it comes to the kind of, you know, these things are won and lost on how many signs say vote yes on initiative 42 or whatever. The forces against school choice are very powerful and very effective. So Nebraska, Kentucky, and Colorado all in various ways, shapes, and forms voted against school choice. It's a bummer. And it continues to suggest to me that maybe direct democracy isn't great.
Although that's what got us marijuana decriminalized eventually in most places. Catherine.
Although it's also what's gotten us the reversal of that trend in some places this cycle. Matt.
Not quite the reversal, it's true, but that democracy isn't great. The alternative is probably worse.
Thanks, Churchill.
Nick, what is something that you noticed of smaller but nonetheless present significance?
Yeah, I mean, one, just to follow up on what Catherine's talking about, drug legalization or decriminalization initiatives did very poorly this time around, which is fascinating because in many ways drugs are becoming, particularly marijuana and psychedelics to some degree, are becoming more normalized, but they did not fare well at the ballot box. And I'll have more to say about that when we talk personnel, Matt Welch, because by then the acid will have kicked in. What I wanted to talk about was for Democrats who want a way forward, because things are, you know, Bernie Sanders put out a thing of, you know, saying like, you know, the real problem is that we didn't go far enough left on economic issues. AOC had a version of that. People like Matt Iglesias, you know, had a different version, which I think makes more sense. But like, if Democrats want to think about how do they do well in, you know, in the current world, they can look to two places. One is the state of Colorado, which basically alone among places in the country that were at all up for grabs, went more to the tipped more blue than red. There are a bunch of maps out there that you can find, one in the Financial Times in particular, that showed the direction of votes in counties, and Colorado actually kind of went blue in a world where everybody was going red. And I think that's because of people like Jared Polis, where again, it is a pro-business, pro-free speech, kind of pro-school choice, kind of positive, open-ended vision of good government that is not overwhelming and is not lecturing people constantly. And that is kind of personified as well in a Marie Glusenkamp Perez, who won re-election. She was she had first been elected last time around in the 3rd District of Washington State, which is one of those weird things that goes from Western Washington all the way to the Pacific, or Eastern Washington all the way to the Pacific Ocean. But she's a pro-gun, pro-abortion, pro-business, anti-regulation congressperson in a deep red district. And she manages to win because she's not insane. And there's a widely circulated video where she's talking about the daycare where one of her kids goes. If the people there, if the helpers there peel bananas or peel oranges, they need to go through a whole rigmarole, because then they are doing prepared food where you can open bags of chips. And she said, you know, like nobody would admit that, you know, that this was a rule. And then they were like, oh, yeah, it is. And it would take like 10 or 11 new sinks in the daycare center in order to comply with all the regulations, you know, just in order to fucking peel a banana for a kid at a daycare. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of nuts. And like, if you zero in on these types of things that are really petty and substantial roadblocks to people just getting on with stuff, you can do pretty well. And if you are, you know, generally speaking, embracing, you know, kind of individual freedom, you know, free minds and free markets, there's a lot of room for you to win elections, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. But Democrats in particular, I think, should be looking towards that kind of model and a kind of polis sort of you know, political vision, rather than saying, oh, what we really need to do is triple down on, you know, Queers for Palestine type of, you know, identity politics, or, you know, really what we need to do is to take over the entire economy and make it work the way that I, Bernie Sanders, want.
Peter, what's a smaller issue that struck your fancy?
In some ways, to follow up on what Nick said and the push from folks like Sanders and AOC to move the Democratic Party left on economic issues in reaction to the election, I think they should all take a look at California and what happened with Proposition 33, which was about rent control. This is the third rent control, the third time voters in California have gotten to take a look at rent control and vote on it. And for the third time in 6 years, they've been like, no. We're not doing that. And I think that is at least partially an outgrowth of the sense that leftist or left-leaning governance in, you know, Democratic governance in California has botched it on housing prices and has just made the state incredibly expensive and difficult to live in. And that is one of the things that we saw in this election, is that, in fact, some of the biggest cities with the highest housing costs were where you saw the biggest swings toward Trump. Places, that's true in New York, that's true in places like Miami, and those bastions of sort of urban blue Democratic, you know, solidarity did not hold up for Democrats. And one reason why is because everybody living in those places can see what Democrats have done when you give them power. At California, they cannot blame Republicans for what is going on in California. That is an all Democratic state. It is a rich state. They've got a lot of money. They can't say, oh, look, it's because of, you know, we're poor and we just need like, that is a rich state. It's richer than most countries. It's all Democrats, all blue, and they've blown it, and their voters are telling them, we don't want this anymore.
Can we say the voters are wrong, just like they are with school choice? I mean, can we resolve this contradiction of, is it good to direct democracy when the people vote to out rent control but it's bad direct democracy when they don't
go for
it.
Nailed it, Nick.
This is what I said earlier, is any problems you might have with direct democracy, well, the alternative is probably worse.
There is, I think there was an intuition in that this is the bad extrapolation from one single election, so take it all with 12 grains of salt, but that the Democratic Party, Harris campaign in particular, could never get beyond like the economic policy is basically we'll give you a bunch of stuff from the government and also price controls. And I think there's a basic understanding among Americans that that is not going to make prices go down if the government is in charge of giving you stuff and then otherwise telling you what you can't do with your stuff or with your activities, that actually prices go up as do taxes. It ain't good. My small thing is less a specific result of a politician, but a poll, one of those subgroups that went heavily more for Trump than last time was Native Americans. And these exit polls are really small, so it's really possible that they're being overly extrapolated. There's already some good argument about that, but the big NBC, I think it was, news exit poll had Native Americans going 64 to 35 for Trump, when normally it's more like 40 to 60 in favor of Democrats. That's a huge switch, big if true, as the kids say. And there was a lot of intentionality among the Trump campaign to vie for those votes. He was going to North Carolina and dangling a possible tribal recognition on the Lumbee tribe.
Oh, wow.
Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, who is the is a Cherokee, is a Republican senator in Oklahoma. He was put there in a 2023 to replace Jim Imhoff. There's a lot of talk about him. He might end up in a position of importance inside the cabinet. Don't know which position that would be. But it had him and Tulsi Gabbard, who's an American Samoan, going and very clearly targeting these communities, especially in swing states like Arizona, and talking about stuff. Quote from Mark Wayne Mullen, President Trump has already made mention of that he's going to have a large understanding of self-determination and sovereignty and understanding what the treaties actually mean. I just find it interesting. I don't know what it means, but I think it might be interesting along with the idea, and it's kind of the underplayed element of Neil Gorsuch and the stuff that he has been focused on in his life. Yes, Chevron deference above all has been very interesting to him, but also tribal rights, Native American rights, especially vis-a-vis the treaties that the United States government has serially done horrible, horrible things with over the years. So just interesting to look at. I don't know what it means. I don't even know exactly where I would stand on some of it. I think there's more of an appetite for some drill baby drill stuff happening on native lands just in general, but also the restoration of riparian habitats and a bunch of other things. So we'll see how that plays out. But I find it just kind of fascinating as someone who's paid attention to this stuff for off and on for 25 years. All right. We're going to get to our listener, belatedly here, to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors over at the University of Chicago. Friends, in an election year, it's very easy to get lost in the fog of news and opinion. Understanding the real-life impact and import of political events can be a challenge. So we've got a podcast to recommend. It's called Not Another Politics Podcast. See what they did there? Brought to you by the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. Not Another Politics Podcast provides clear, research-driven perspectives on the biggest issues of the day. Get the insights you need to truly understand the political landscape. No spin, just facts. Subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP, or just look for Not Another Politics Podcast wherever you find such things. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from frequent emailer, and thank you for them, Curtis Everett, who writes simply, tersely, thoughts on Trump cabinet choices. Nick, do you have any thoughts on Trump cabinet choices?
Yeah, well, here is an interesting one. And, you know, who knows the reality of the actual situation? But, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been saying that he is going to be in charge of America's health. And he's part of the MAHA movement, the Make America Healthy Again movement. And Donald Trump at his Madison Square Garden rally said that he was going to put RFK Jr. in charge of our health, which comes down to, you know, getting rid of various kinds of innocuous dyes and things like that. There's a widely circulated video of him going after tartrazine, which is what makes Captain Crunch yellow. And, you know, when we get, if we can pull on that thread, Matt, you know, everything's going to be all right. So, like, I'm both worried about that because RFK Jr. is batshit crazy. I mean, like, he is a nut job and a delusional, you know, thinker on many, many things. But what the reason why I'm interested that if he has a big role to play is he may well be the person who ushers in an era of heavily decriminalized or legalized psychedelics. RFK Jr. has a long history as a drug addict as well, you know, and he comes from a family that is, you know, has more substance abuse problems than they have courtesans. You know, this is like a big thing, but he is absolutely steadfast in saying, like, you don't fix any of this through prohibition. And he talks very positively about moving psychedelics forward as ways of helping people deal with all sorts of problems. And this is where his anti-pharma positioning actually may help legalize a bunch of what the government calls illicit drugs, you know, things like weed, things like psychedelics, et cetera, because they're not yet in the pharmaceutical arena, because they can't be, because research on them and, you know, and certainly sales and distribution and marketing are either illegal or so heavily circumscribed that you can't get done. So we may be standing on the threshold of RFK Jr., you know, a guy who is on testosterone and like human growth hormone and steroids up the yin yang, who has a dead worm in his brain that has never been removed by his own testimony, and is like a former junkie. Maybe the person with Donald Trump, who is the least psychedelic person you could imagine. Like ChatGPT couldn't come up with a more anti-psychedelic persona than Donald Trump, but they may be the ones who you know, push a lot of this through in a way that would be a great, wonderful, ironic trip, so to speak.
So the edibles did kick in is what I'm hearing from you, Dick. Peter, thoughts on Trump cabinet choices?
We still don't have a ton of information on where he's going here, but the early word seems to suggest that he's going to be picking people who are semi-competent, but mostly extremely loyal and hardcore on his major issues, the border, basically, immigration enforcement and tariffs. And so you've got people like the border czar, you know, who's going to be a top advisor, Tom Homan, who's just like, you know, we're going to do a whole bunch of deportations, but they're going to be orderly and nice. You'll like them, because that's how like mass deportation typically works. We've got, you know, rumors of like Lighthizer being in charge of trade policy, somebody who's just an absolute, you know, border hawk, tariff hawk in that sense. And so I would just expect to see people who, on the one hand, have records of actually at least talking and thinking about these issues, people who are not just sort of pulled out of the blue, you know, sort of names you've never heard before, but also folks who are really quite hardcore on those core Trump economic issues in particular.
Catherine, what's interest to you in Trump cabinet choices?
Yeah, I mean, I want to come back to Tom Homan, because I do think that's a really important one. It was one of the first people that he kind of formally announced. And he was responsible for the zero tolerance policy under the first Trump administration that separated families. He will come in with a much stronger mandate even than he did before. It's a huge contrast to Biden kind of half-assedly saying, like, maybe like Kamala Harris will be sort of in charge down there.
Wait, she was definitely never the border czar. Well, I read many publications that published pieces saying she was the border czar. Say 2 years later, she absolutely wasn't.
She was never the border czar. So it is a marked contrast, because this guy has a very clear record. We know what he's going to do. It's going to be you know, with Trump's kind of full-throated endorsement. I guess the other not cabinet pick I would note is not Nikki Haley. So just for those who are still keeping track of the Catherine talks about Nikki Haley on this podcast thread, not Nikki Haley has been very clear. Pompeo and Haley are out. So
never.
I believe Homan was actually asked about family separation and how you could avoid that. And he was just like, well, that's easy. We'll deport the whole family.
You can't do that legally. But I will remind people that President-elect Trump, before when he was running, vowed to the Libertarian Party as part of them being very MAGA curious that he would nominate a Libertarian in his cabinet. And he didn't specify the capitalization. But there's been some chatter, maybe self-generated, I'm not exactly sure, that Thomas Massie, a very strongly Libertarian-leaning congressman in Kentucky and half-crazy person who I have always enjoyed, might be up for something like Ag Secretary or some role of importance. I think that would be awesome. Be really great to get Thomas Massie in a place where he can do more than a backbenching congressman can do. Although he's done some good stuff, he's always the one voice in a voice vote to say no, you have to vote, and that kind of stuff, which is great and fun. But it'd be great if he was in there. And I hope that even if he is nominated, that we're not done with libertarians. And again, as I was mentioning before, I'm grateful that there are people like even Vivek Ramaswamy, who I disagree with about a lot of things, but he's libertarian curious. I like that he's around. I wouldn't necessarily, I've heard, I saw some reporting today that he's in the final four for Secretary of State. No, please, no. Don't do that one. But I don't mind him being around just sort of whispering like, hey, maybe cut government. That would be really great.
Yeah, but he's not going to do that. Along with Zach Weisweller, I'm saying he's not going to say cut government. Zach Weisweller and I asked him that directly when he started his campaign, because he was like, we got to cut government when he was running for president. It was like, what would you cut? And he immediately started talking about growing the economy. He is one of those people who will not commit to any goddamn thing being cut ever.
Send out our abolish everything
yeah.
over to the new administration.
You know, the Massie pick at agriculture would be fascinating, since the USDA also runs like the food stamp program. I don't know how well he would fare. I know what his policies would be and how hard he would work to do them. I think that would be an amazing pick and saga to follow, because there's a reason why the USDA, why farm subsidies and price supports and everything don't shrink. And it's because, it's the ultimate concentrated benefits, distributed costs. And it would be great to see Massie really take a hammer to all that.
Just want to ask everyone, though, who is feeling optimistic about any of this, to go back and look at what even Reason, but libertarians in general, said in 2016 about what kind of libertarian presence there might be in a Trump administration. And we tried really hard to be sane and calm and moderate and put our best handicap on how this would go. And we were still far too optimistic. And I just want to say that again here. Like, all of the things that we are saying right now, I think we are being too optimistic about the presence of principled libertarianism in Trump's inner circle. Now, it doesn't mean some libertarian things that libertarians like won't happen. They will. But the presence of voices for liberty in Trump's inner circle did not pan out in 2016. I don't see any reason to think it will pan out more this time around.
I see it less
ran
as
on
like
a big government policy platform.
Yes, I see it less as any faith. I'm just glad that there's anyone around within scope rifle distance. That's a bad analogy now that he's been assassinated.
Let's not use that one. And you're right that nobody would have been in Harris's inner circle either, right?
Sure. So I want someone even in the outer circle. It's better than not having them now, is what I'm saying about all that. Like, I don't think that Rand Paul is going to have much of a say on with Donald Trump. Maybe have a little bit, because if he endorsed him, it was like at the last possible minute. And I don't even remember if he did or not. But I'm just glad there's some people left. I might have disagreed with how they got there, but that there are anyone around there, that's good. And then it's more of a case-by-case basis. And I think the one that comes to mind from 2016 is that Donald Trump did campaign a little bit on deregulatory stuff. And a lot of libertarians, including probably myself and probably us, like, yeah, it's probably not going to really amount to much. But it did. It amounted to at least some. So it's possible that on very targeted specific issues, he'll be slightly better. I'm going to initiate, stop it. I hear you talking, don't do it. Because I really want to get to this last bit, but we have to do it quickly. A couple of days ago, Elon Musk, Catherine's sexy South African boyfriend, tweeted out a video of Donald Trump laying out what he describes as his anti-censorship agenda for the Trump 2.0 White House, including stopping all federal government censorious pressure on social media companies or individuals, investigating the scope of the censorship industrial complex, firing those employees who engaged in it, plus some other stuff we don't like. Like repealing Section 230 of the 1996 Telecommunications Act. As it turns out, the video is 2 years old. Whoops. But again, those people that we've already name-checked on this podcast, Elon, RFK, Jay, and Vivek, have been like mashing the retweet button and getting really excited about the idea of Trump 2.0 White House, what it might do with censorship. So, Peter, quickly, if you can, and everyone quickly, if you can, what did you see in that video that seems plausible and good and bad? And like, what do you think?
So it's a 2-year-old video, which means that Trump might have completely changed his mind by now. Yeah. But if we take that as the playbook, I think that it is half good and half terrifying. And the half good part is basically all the stuff he wants to do inside the federal government. He wants to cut off funding to disinformation and misinformation research groups and labeling groups. I think, great. He wants to fire the bureaucrats that participated in a sort of government encouraged or directed or nudged quasi-censorship through social media. Yes, I understand that if it's private, it's not technically kind of censorship. But once you involve, you know, White House staffers, that makes it a little more censorship-y. And then the second half of the things he wants to do, it's basically all open-ended investigations into his political enemies. And that is bad. Even if you don't like those people, even if you think that these are that these groups are doing things that shouldn't be done, they're running shaming campaigns against Twitter, stopping advertisers, you know, running boycotts, that sort of thing. Even if you think that that's terrible and those groups are bad, using the Justice Department to run open-ended investigations where you say, we don't know what the crime is. We don't even really know if there is a crime here, but we're just going to go looking. That was bad when they did it to Donald Trump, and it's going to be bad when he does it to other groups.
Catherine, quick thoughts.
Seeing a bunch of conservatives' tweets at the top of Twitter is not the same thing as we have free speech now.
That's sad. Nick, you're going to interview Martin Gurry, who said he was going to vote for Trump because of free speech.
Same week that the Democrats are the party of control.
The same week that I think Trump sued at least two news organizations and talked about like he filed suit, I think, at least on one of those, and threatened to, like I said, the 60 Minutes should be stricken from the airwaves.
Like, because they made terrible editing choices. You know, I didn't like that angle in that one interview. It's insane. What I'll say about this, I don't trust Trump to be great on speech or anything like that. There is a moment for a reinvigoration of legacy media as well as social media. Mark Zuckerberg is back into a libertarian phase, and like, glory be, maybe Facebook will become better than it has been, you know, on some dimension. And Catherine mentioned Jeff Bezos, you know, he was trying to unload, by most accounts, trying to unload the Washington Post. You know, one of the ways to do it and to turn around its massive and continuing decline in readership is maybe by making it more interesting and less of a democracy dies in darkness echo chamber, which, you know, even now, like, you know, the people who didn't quit the Washington Post when it refused to endorse Kamala, you know, they're still writing that same story about how, like, oh, this is the end of everything. Like, maybe we'll see, you know, people like Bezos kind of be like, hey, you know what? Let's have an actual interesting newspaper again.
All right, let's get to our end of podcast. What we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Peter, why don't you start us off?
I saw the movie Anora. It is the new film from Sean Baker, who's the director of movies like The Florida Project and Red Rocket. He is perhaps the greatest chronicler of sort of people living at the fringes of American life generally, but sex workers and sex work in America more specifically. And so this is a movie about a stripper in Brighton Beach in New York. And it is about, it's a sort of a remake in some ways, or a riff on the Pretty Woman formula, because she gets connected with a rich guy who is going to sort of you know, sort of take her and change her life and make her a princess. Except this rich guy, instead of being a businessman like Richard Gere, he is the young son of a Russian oligarch. And it turns out that this beautiful, wonderful, fun, carefree life that he has promised her and that they get that she marries into, well, it's a little more complicated than that. And what happens is she marries him, and that's the big turn in the first act. And then the family revolts and says, absolutely not. Because what happens when you marry somebody, then you have an obligation to them that is no longer financial, that's more than that. And so they send all of their Armenian minders to the compound of this young, you know, oligarch's son house. And the son runs off, which means that you end up with this movie, the whole second act, the middle section of it is Honora, the stripper who has married into the family. And then the three minders, and they're all just like bumming around sort of far New York, Brooklyn area, trying to find this dipshit who has just run off on this situation. And they just sort of tour an ethnic working class part of New York. And you get to sort of see the whole thing. And it is this beautiful slice of working class life in which everybody is kind of tied to somebody richer and, you know, who they all have these obligations. And they're all just trying to survive and work it out. And it's this great movie about the working class and about the strangeness of the economy right now and about New York and about Russian-American relations. And it's just, it's very funny without being saccharine or, you know, sort of sugarcoating things too much. It doesn't ultimately give her the princess ending that you get in Pretty Woman. In fact, it's much more sort of realistic about it. But it's so it's gritty in a way, but also not dark and depressing. Very funny, wonderful, almost sort of classic screwball romantic comedy, but with a very modern edge. And a movie that says something, I think, about work and the dignity and value of work in America today.
Catherine, what did you consume?
Rockets. Always rockets. I went to the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center, which is the annex of the Air and Space Museum out by Dulles Airport. I had some family in town, and so my small nephews and I ran around and looked at various airborne vehicles, formerly airborne vehicles. None of them were airborne at the moment because they were in a museum, including the Space Shuttle Discovery. The Enola Gay is in there, too. It's a really cool museum. It's just this huge, huge place full of huge, huge planes and space vehicles that really make you appreciate what humanity has accomplished. There's a little section in the back for vertical takeoff vehicles, so helicopters and stuff. And the most favorite vehicle of many members of my family was something that you could buy for $100 in the 50s, which you attached to the back of your car, and it had kind of skis and a little bicycle and like a rotor, and you could just whee off to work.
How would you get to work?
You heard me. And not only was this a great little vehicle, which notes on the sign that you did not need a special license to operate as long as it remained tethered to the vehicle, but also provided an opportunity to talk about inflation because my daughter wondered if she had enough money in her bank account right now to buy such a vehicle.
How much is $100 in 1954 worth today, Catherine?
I think we figured out it was a little over $1,000. So this was just all around a delightful time, had nothing to do with the election, and I can't recommend those types of pastimes enough.
The Udvar-Hazy Center, I believe, is one of only two places in the United States, or the world, actually, where you can see a real SR-71 Blackbird spy plane on display just as a civilian.
It's just parked there in the middle.
The other one was where I grew up in the panhandle of Florida at the little museum that Eglin Air Force Base had. But the one at Udvar-Hazy turned into a Transformer played by Leonard Nimoy in, I believe, Transformers 2. Great little sequence.
Nick, what did you consume?
I watched the Netflix documentary Martha, which is about Martha Stewart. And it is a great story, particularly for libertarians in a couple of ways. One, just the focus on her prosecution that ended up putting her in the slammer in the federal penitentiary for 5 months or so. Everybody, to the extent that anybody remembers Martha Stewart's fall from grace, They think that she was found guilty of insider trading, which she was never charged with, or it didn't stick. And she was basically charged with lying to federal investigators because she asserted her innocence both publicly and in conversations with them. It goes into that, and it is fascinating to go back at this point, 20 years ago, at the when the stock market collapsed and when the tech bubble burst. The government, along with the American public, was looking for a scapegoat. And Martha Stewart is the one who really rose to the level of publicity. And she was, it's wrong. She was attacked and put in jail for not doing anything wrong, actually. So that's an interesting story of government overreach. But it's also, why was she so popular? She really created a kind of media empire that is almost impossible to think about anymore. She was one of the last great innovators where she had a couple books that did well. I mean, she started as a caterer, had a couple books, had a magazine that became very popular, a bunch of TV shows, and created this vast empire that was really all built around her persona and the idea of kind of being a new version of a housewife, but also of just intentional living and kind of like making better choices in, how you put food together because you're doing it anyway, how you put your house together. And it's very good. She's involved in the production of it, but it does not, unlike many of these documentaries that we've talked about a lot, there's a lot of darkness around the edges that they go into about her and about, she is famously described as an incredibly icy, cold, kind of barren person emotionally. And that comes through and they go into that a bit. It's really an interesting look at how somebody who's just a great American self-made story, how she did that, how the government fucked her over, and then kind of how she came back in a, slightly campy version of herself. So I highly recommend Martha, the Netflix documentary about Martha Stewart's rise and fall and rise again.
I wish that I could, in good conscience, really recommend the documentary that I saw, since it's about my single favorite rock and roll piano player and session man, Nicky Hopkins. It's called Session Man, as a matter of fact. It just came out last week. Only recommend it for hardcore Nicky Hopkins heads and maybe some people who are really, really into late 60s and 70s music and for bits. It's not a very well-made documentary. They basically crowdfunded it. I think I might have even contributed to it. I certainly passed around their information. And what are you going to expect from a threadbare music documentary? What's the big problem? They didn't get the music rights. So like, it's a really about a guy who played piano like nobody else did. You've heard him in You Are So Beautiful by Joe Cocker and Sympathy for the Devil and Angie and plenty of other things from the Rolling Stones. She's a Rainbow, Jealous Guy by John Lennon. It's one of those people who, for me, very much like the Wrecking Crew, the famous West Coast studio band. Like, you always wondered, like, why do I really like this Simon and Garfunkel song or this song? Right? It's all because those guys were playing on all of them. He's that type of guy. Like, that George Harrison song that you love or Ringo Starr song that you love. Oh, yeah, it's because he was playing piano. They didn't get really the rights. There's a lot. It's directed by a guy named Michael Treen. I don't really know anything about him. They have interviews with people there who just, like, have nothing to add to it. The only kind of found footage they get of Nicky Hopkins himself, who died, he had Crohn's disease, right? So he's a skinny little guy. And of course, if you hang out with the Rolling Stones too much and have Crohn's disease, you're just not going to live very long. And he died in 1994 at age 50. And it's very, very sad. Played on 250 albums, not even like songs, but it's incredibly prolific. And like, they only find one single interview from him in 1991. So the hair is really bad. They get some musicians. And the thing that's recommendable about it for those who are really super into music is to try to watch people who are themselves great musicians. Jim Keltner, the famous session drummer. Keith Richards is probably the best at this in there. Try to put into words, find their vocabulary to describe something that's so ephemeral and beautiful, and it's great. Occasionally they do. They get around a bit of the music problem by having some piano players, session and otherwise, go and like just recreate it and try to explain to you why that is so inventive and interesting. So you get to hear some of the runs. that he did. But so there's about, it's a 90-minute documentary. About 35 minutes are pure gold. And the rest is just like, oh, gosh, well, I hope they use that footage for a real documentary someday. But it's called Session Man. I loved watching it, despite its flaws, if you're as weird as I am like that. So maybe Nick.
Yeah. Do they hint at why he was so good? I mean, other than he's just a genius. Like,
I don't want to steal it, but think I'm going to, because it's such a weird choice. In the last 90 seconds of the documentary, one of the characters who'd been on it and who had added nothing up until this point, like he was just like, oh, I don't really know anything about it, said, oh yeah, you know, one thing that he always told me and he was very insistent on is that he was the reincarnation of Frédéric Chopin. And he's like, he hadn't been weird up until this moment. I mean, he's been unusual in certain ways, but like he was dead set. And suddenly they're cutting to five or six other people. It's like, oh yeah, like he wouldn't stop. He was Chopin. He knew it. He knew that he'd been brought. That's awesome, right? Like, why are you burying that lead? I'm not so sure about that one. Classical training, just 1960, came up at the right time, kind of combination of things. They tried to get to it, but they had a hard time figuring it. It was more like they could describe in their halting language why they felt it was so special, but you didn't get a lot of sense of his own kind of interior life for it. And man, they spent like a good 5 minutes talking about Terry and the Pirates before you even like find out that he played on the Imagine record. It's just like, what are you doing, people? But anyways, Session Man, check it out if you're into that kind of stuff. We are done with the normal part of the podcast, but I want to direct everyone's attention to that The Reason Roundtable, like I think all of our podcasts at Reason, has become its own separate YouTube channel. Here's what I'm telling you to do. Go subscribe to it. Mash that button. Subscribe to The Reason Roundtable at your YouTubes. Very easy to do it. If you just click on this post, if you're seeing it through YouTube, just hit the subscribe. It's good. Come on. Do the thing. All right. Speaking of the thing, Nick Gillespie, I mentioned Martin Gurry. Is there still seats available to that?
There are a few seats available next Monday, a week from today. I'm interviewing Martin Gurry, who in 2014 published Revolt of the Public, which is the essential guide to what's been going on in politics for most of the 21st century. He's an ex-CIA analyst who is now a Mercatus Center research fellow. Fascinating look at how authority and legacy institutions, whether it's government or media, you name it, are in a crisis of authority and that they still don't get it. In preparing for this, reading the first version of Revolt of the Public, it is uncanny when he's describing the media, the meltdown they were having in the early teens is exactly what's happening again now, post Trump's second victory. So go to reason.com/events. It's at a great place called Maxwell Social in Tribeca. It's going to be a fantastic evening with a great crowd of people. Really good conversation.
Go to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. If you'd like to donate to the nonprofit foundation that makes our work possible, go to reason.com/donate. And besides that, I think that we've hit all the buttons. Marked all the boxes. We will see you next Monday on Martin Gurry Day, as it's known. Hope you had a safe and sane election. And let's go boldly into the future. Goodbye.